Support for this podcast comes from Avangrid. Tom Turnwald runs an Ohio millwork company that was started by his father and employs his kids.
I'm in favor of wind farms because I'm committed to attracting talent to our community, and the school districts with wind turbines get resources that can make a huge difference in kids' lives.
Since 2012, an Avangrid wind farm has strengthened the economy and contributes millions to the community each year. To learn more about where energy meets humanity, visit avangrid.com. That's avangrid.com.
From the New York Times, I'm Michael Barbaro. This is The Daily. Today, in Saudi Arabia, the president went before the leaders of the Muslim world, calling for unity against extremism and saying it's up to them to purge their countries of the, quote, foot soldiers of evil. And a Times investigation finds that the Chinese government intentionally crippled U.S. spying operations there by killing CIA informants. It's Monday, May 22nd. Good afternoon. I'm trying to reach a guest named Peter Baker.
Mr. Peter?
Yes, last name is Baker. B-A-K-E-R.
Baker. Absolutely, ma'am. Allow me a moment.
Hello?
Hello?
White House reporter Peter Baker is in Riyadh, Saudi Arabia, with the president. I spoke to him on Sunday evening. So this trip started on Friday. Give us a bit of an overview of what's happened over the past couple of days.
Right. Well, he left Washington Friday amid scandal and intrigue and investigations. And I think he wasn't looking forward to the trip, but he probably didn't mind getting away from all that, at least. And he landed very early Washington time in Saudi Arabia and headed pretty quickly to a series of meetings. He met with the king of Saudi Arabia, the crown prince, the deputy crown prince. He went to an event last night that includes some dancing, traditional dancing of Saudis in white robes, a sword. At one point, the president even kind of sort of shimmied a little bit.
Shimmied, you say?
Shimmied, swayed, you know, pick a good word.
Right.
Rex Tillerson actually got into it a little bit more than the president did. And he seemed to be carrying the sword. He was asked about that today by one of the interviewers.
We all got to see the video yesterday of you participating in that traditional Arab sword dance, and I have to tell you, you looked pretty good while you were doing it. Frankly, more comfortable than the president or Commerce Secretary Ross. Had you been practicing, sir?
Well, I hadn't been practicing, Chris, but it was not my first sword dance.
So the Saudis are so eager to please this president that they, first of all, they projected a giant multi-story image of his face on the Ritz-Carlton hotel where he's staying.
Wow.
So if you're driving up to the hotel, there's Donald Trump staring at you, you know, hundreds of feet tall. And they also sponsored a country music concert by Toby Keith here. Men only. Women weren't allowed at the concert. This is Saudi Arabia. The president himself didn't actually go. He was in a golf court and rode by a large screen where the concert was playing. He did stop and watch it for a few minutes before moving on. But, you know, so it's a mix of pomp and circumstance and serious policy and diplomatic meetings.
I would like to thank King Salman for his extraordinary words and the magnificent kingdom of Saudi Arabia for hosting today's summit.
I want to focus on the big speech that the president gave on Sunday. You were there. Tell us about it.
Right. Well, it was a large group of leaders from the Muslim world, not just the Arab world, but from around the Muslim world. And he gave it here in Riyadh at a large conference center room, very palatial. And it was, you know, it was meant to be a summit meeting that would bring American and Muslim leaders together.
We must be united in pursuing the one goal that transcends every other consideration. That goal is to meet history's great test, to conquer extremism and vanquish the forces that terrorism brings with it every single time.
It was symbolic for a president who has, of course, said he wouldn't allow Muslims even to come into the United States because he was worried about terrorism. Mm-hmm.
Donald J. Trump is calling for a total and complete shutdown of Muslims entering the United States until our country's representatives can figure out what the hell is going on.
Here, he did not mention that. No talk of a Muslim ban. Instead, he was careful to praise them for the actions that they have taken to fight extremism and terrorism, and to mention that most victims of terrorism, in fact, are Muslims. So he reached out in that sense.
They have borne the brunt of the killings and the worst of the destruction in this wave of fanatical violence. Some estimates hold that more than 95% of the victims of terrorism are themselves Muslim.
At the same time, he challenged them.
The first task in this joint effort is for your nations to deny all territory to the foot soldiers of evil. Every country in the region has an absolute duty to ensure that terrorists find no sanctuary on their soil.
He said, look, you need to make a decision as to whether you're going to genuinely fight extremism or not.
A better future is only possible if your nations drive out the terrorists and drive out the extremists. Drive them out. Drive them out of your places of worship. Drive them out of your communities. Drive them out of your holy land. And drive them out of this earth.
So it was a mixed message. I think he was kind of pivoting away from the 2016 campaign rhetoric, but also pivoting away from what he saw as President Obama's unwillingness to challenge Muslim countries here to fight terrorism more effectively. The one thing he made a mistake on was a money line, though. One thing they wanted to do was kind of move past that phrase he'd like to use all the time, radical Islamic extremism or radical Islamic terrorism. Remember, he criticized President Obama and anybody else who didn't use that.
We're in a war against radical Islam, but President Obama won't even name the enemy. And unless you name the enemy, you will never, ever solve the problem.
Well, he switched in this speech. This speech, they changed it to Islamist with a T, extremism. And there's a difference. It sounds small, but to people in this world, that's a big difference, because Islamists are people who have twisted and warped Islam according to many people, and as opposed to saying Islamic terrorism, which implies that the religion as a whole is related to terrorism. Now, the problem is that when he came to that part in the speech,
there is still much work to be done.
He stumbled over the words, and he came back to Islamic as well as the word Islamist.
That means honestly confronting the crisis of Islamic extremism and the Islamicists and Islamic terror of all kinds. We must
use both of them at different points in the sentence, because I think he's a little tired and he kind of he tripped up.
So, Peter, I watched the speech from home and I was struck by a particular phrase.
We must seek partners, not perfection, and to make allies of all who share our goals.
Partners, not perfection. What do you think that meant, and what was it supposed to mean to the Muslim heads of state who he was talking to in that room?
What he meant was, I'm not going to lecture you. He even said,
we are not here to lecture. We are not here to tell other people how to live, what to do, who to be.
That is the perception, fairly or not, that a lot of people in that room have of President Obama.
America will not seek to impose our way of life on others, but to outstretch our hands in the spirit of cooperation and trust.
And so, in effect, what President Trump was saying, look, I'm not going to scold you about your human rights abuses. I'm not going to try to tell you how to live your lives or run your countries, but you need to work with me here on this issue and we'll be fine. What past presidents have thought,
I do have an unyielding belief that all people yearn for certain things. The ability to speak your mind.
Both Bush and Obama, is that there is in fact a link between human rights abuses and terrorism, that you can't in fact link those two.
The freedom to live as you choose. These are not just American ideas, they are human rights. And that is why we will support them everywhere.
so to encourage Muslim countries to do more to open up their societies, to provide more opportunity, to provide more freedom and expression, that would be a factor in fighting extremism. That's not the way President Trump saw it. When he talked about the oppression of women, he wasn't talking about the Saudi government, which doesn't allow women to even drive here, much less hold many positions. He was talking about what ISIS and terrorist groups do to women, which, of course, is also a source of great concern. So, you know, he was willing to talk about human rights and freedom in terms of terrorist groups and in terms of Iran, which is he considers to be a top adversary here in the region, but he was not willing to talk about those things with Saudi Arabia and Egypt and these other countries that he considers to be allies. His view is it's not for us to get involved in their domestic concerns, and to the extent that we do, it's better that we do it privately, and we'll have a better, more effective impact. What critics, of course, would say is, you know, we're sacrificing the values that we have always espoused around the world, and particularly in the last 10 or 12 years.
So finally, Peter, where are you headed from here? What's next for you?
Well, at 2:45 in the morning, we're going to leave the hotel, and we're going to go to the airport to head to Israel. We're going to the president will fly a little later than we will, but we're going to fly first to Tel Aviv and then go from there to Jerusalem, where the president will visit the Western Wall and meet and have dinner with Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, and then also go to Bethlehem, which is in the West Bank, to meet with President Mahmoud Abbas of the Palestinian Authority. So that should be a very interesting trip, his first to Israel as president, and at a time when he thinks he can actually help bring about Middle East peace in a way that no president has before.
So I assume you're going to somehow sleep between 8:30 p.m. local time and 2 a.m. local time.
Well, fortunately, there'll be a plane to sleep on the flight, but it's gonna be a long night.
All right, good luck. Enjoy the few hours of sleep you're going to get.
Thanks very much.
Bye, Peter.
Have a good evening. Bye.
We'll be right back.
Many think of beauty and health as disconnected, but beauty and wellness are really two sides of the same coin. Hello, I'm Isabella Rossellini, and in the final episode of This Is Not a Beauty podcast, we'll hear from a cancer survivor, an anthropologist, and a carer of the elderly about the relationship between beauty and health. Listen now on your favorite podcast platform.
This podcast is supported by ACLU. The ACLU knows exactly what threats a second Donald Trump term presents, and they are ready with a battle-tested playbook. The ACLU took legal action against the first Trump administration 434 times, and they will do it again to protect immigrants' rights, defend reproductive freedom, safeguard free speech, and fight for all of our fundamental civil rights. Join the ACLU today to help stop the Extreme Project 2025 agenda. Learn more at ACLU.org.
I use New York Times Cooking at least 3 to 4 times a week.
I love sheet pan bibimbap. It said 35 minutes. It was 35 minutes.
The cucumber salad with soy, ginger, and garlic. Oh my God, that is just to die for.
This turkey chili has over 17,000 5-star ratings. So easy, so delicious.
The instructions are so clear, so simple, and it just works.
Hey, it's Eric Kim from New York Times Cooking. Come cook with us. Go to nytcooking.com.
So what started happening inside China around 2010?
People started going missing. In late 2010, early 2011, there were individuals in China who were being either killed, sometimes in public fashion, or they were put in prison. And it was a mystery about what was happening.
My colleague Mark Mazzetti is an editor at The Times and has been investigating these deaths and disappearances.
Best we can tell is they were primarily government employees, people who had access to the power centers in Beijing, people who knew information about corruption in the Chinese government, other secrets about China's government that the Chinese would not want spilled out into public.
And what is your reporting now revealed about why these people were killed or imprisoned?
They were working for the CIA. The CIA, a couple years before that, had been building up its network of informants in China. They had been making good progress, according to the people we spoke to, for several years. And then, almost immediately, and in rapid succession, these people who had been providing information started to disappear. And the CIA, who had built up this network, immediately started thinking, we have a problem here. And the FBI knew that there was a problem as well.
And in the end, Mark, how many CIA informants are we talking about here? How many were imprisoned or killed during this period?
The people we spoke to said that somewhere between 18 to 20 had been imprisoned or killed during a two-year period, roughly from around late 2010 to 2012. And with a more than a dozen of those actually killed, including one, we were told, who was shot in the courtyard of a government building in front of colleagues as a message to others who might consider spying for the CIA.
So let me slow that down. He was basically executed in front of his colleagues in a public fashion in a Chinese government office.
That's our understanding. And it was a not at all subtle message that this is what happens to you if you're caught spying for the Americans.
Mark, how big is the United States espionage program inside China, and what exactly is its purpose?
Size is always difficult to assess. Certainly, the Beijing station for the CIA would be large. It would be one of the largest that the CIA has. And the purpose would be to gather information about what's the decision-making in the Chinese government, who might be disillusioned with the party, who would be potential people to turn into sources of information. What is China's strategy for North Korea, for India, et cetera, any number of things you'd want to know about a big, important country like China.
So presumably the identities of United States informants in a foreign country like China are extremely classified and fiercely safeguarded. So what exactly happened that allowed the Chinese to figure out who our spies were inside China?
When your sources start to be rolled up, then the question is, do you have a mole inside the CIA giving the Chinese the names? Is there some other problem? People started narrowed it down to really one of those things. It was either a mole or perhaps a technical problem, that the system that the CIA had set up to communicate with its sources had somehow been hacked or corrupted in some way that allowed the Chinese to find out who was talking to the Americans.
So which one of those possibilities is more worrisome to the United States intelligence world, which you've covered for a really long time? Is it the idea that the Chinese basically broke into our communication system, or that there is a Chinese mole inside the U.S. intelligence world? Or are they both equally awful possibilities?
They're both bad, but the latter would be far worse. The idea that there was someone who had been given access to sort of the keys to the kingdom of all the secrets involving China, who was so central to the effort that they knew the identities of sources. If that person had, in fact, been turned into a sort of double agent and working for the Chinese, that's far greater than a technical problem. I mean, technical problems, while bad, they can be fixed. But if you really have a mole at the center of an agency, that could do damage for years or decades.
So how extensive is the United States' effort to get to the bottom of this, and what does it look like?
The effort is joint between the CIA and the FBI. They set up an office in Northern Virginia. They build lists of people who could be possible suspects. They try to narrow down lists based on whether a certain individual might or might not have access to certain information or the identities of certain sources. They can cross them off the list, narrow it down and closer and closer. But we do know that there was one individual that they looked at, they focused on, they thought might be a particularly likely suspect, but it was not anything that they believed could, convince a judge or convince anyone to bring criminal charges. And some people said, you know what? There isn't a mole. There is just, we had a communications problem. We had a technical problem. You know, the guys overseas were using sloppy tradecraft. They were just going to the same restaurants to meet sources. So the Chinese would have made it, it would have made it easy for the Chinese to find these people. So, I mean, these are all the sort of complicated dynamics that are involved in these cases.
Mark, help me understand that. Why would it matter that some of these informants were going to the same restaurants inside China?
One thing that we believe was happening, according to some people we were speaking to, was that some of these source meetings between CIA officers and Chinese informants were happening in restaurants that, in fact, were pretty well wired by Chinese surveillance, by Chinese intelligence. You had waiters who were working for Chinese intelligence. And some of these meetings were happening, you know, repeatedly. So they were detecting a pattern. And that was one of the things. And that's just basically that it's called sloppy tradecraft, where the more you go to a restaurant, the more the Chinese might be wise to that. And they might therefore ensure that the person serving your food is actually going to be a member of Chinese intelligence. The other interesting dynamic going on here is we have to remember that this is the period of time when the CIA has basically spent 10 years or so focused, not exclusively, but singularly on terrorism, on Al-Qaeda, on finding bin Laden. That doesn't mean that they didn't spy in China or Russia, but there's no question that for this period of time, espionage operations against big countries like Russia and China were not the number one priority of the CIA.
So are you saying, Mark, that while the CIA has been successful in establishing this network in China, it might not have been as focused on maintaining it or on the tradecraft aspects of that because the priority inside the CIA was terrorism?
I think it could be. I think that it's not, and I don't want to say that was the case, and I don't want to overstate that, but I do think that the CIA director at the time, Leon Panetta, was not as focused on what was happening in the station in Beijing as he was on whether Osama bin Laden was inside of a specific compound in Pakistan and whether that would be an operation that could ultimately capture or kill bin Laden. So that was the singular priority of the CIA director at the time.
And how does this affect the United States' relationship with China? Has it done any damage?
Well, that's always hard to know. Again, some of it is big, important countries usually try to take the sort of spy games and not let them seep into the center of a diplomatic relationship. In other words, we spy on you, you spy on us, we understand. And while it's bad and it does complicate things, usually there are other voices in a relationship to try to get above, to understand that the two countries have bigger interests than tanking a relationship over this.
So, Mark, given everything you've told us about what the Chinese discovered and their response, where is the United States espionage program in China? Do we have the kind of visibility into their government that we had before they discovered these informants?
This was a crippling episode, and the people we spoke to said that the damage that was done will take a long time to bounce back from, to rebuild a network that had been pretty severely decimated. We do believe that there have been efforts to rebuild it, rebuild up a source network, but it's something that could take a number of years.
Mark, thank you very much. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Here's what else you need to know today.
Mr. Secretary, you were in the Oval Office when the president met with Russian Foreign Minister Lavrov on May 10th. And according to the official summary, the president told Lavrov, "I just fired the head of the FBI. He was crazy, a real nut job."
In an interview Sunday with Fox News' Chris Wallace, Secretary of State Rex Tillerson responded to reporting in the Times about what President Trump told Russian officials the day after the White House fired FBI Director James Comey.
Was he telling the Russians that firing Comey was taking off legal and political pressure?
Chris, that's not my my interpretation, certainly, of the conversation. And I think what the president was trying to convey to the Russians is, look, I'm not going to be distracted by this all these issues that are here home.
Comey is expected to give his side of the story later this month when he testifies before the Senate Intelligence Committee. And Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan says he will extend a state of emergency that he put in place last summer after an attempted coup, allowing him to imprison tens of thousands of people, close down opposition groups, and silence the media. The decision lets Erdogan keep issuing decrees without oversight from Turkey's parliament or courts, and means the country may operate under authoritarian rule indefinitely. That's it for The Daily. I'm Michael Barbaro. See you tomorrow.